Hello world, I'm Kate Armstrong and this is Future Talks. Future Talks is a series of conversations with friends of FabLab Barcelona, exploring the nature of emergent futures from the past to the present and beyond. For this episode, we invited Kate Raworth, the thinker behind Donut Economics. Donut Economics uses a donut shape to create a visual framework for sustainable development. It combines the concept of planetary boundaries with the complementary concept of social boundaries. Tomás Díaz caught up with Kate at the Fab City Summit in Amsterdam during We Make the City Festival in 2019. In this episode, they talk about new models of thinking around sustainability, economics, and localizing production within the frame of Fab City, the international movement promoted by FabLab Barcelona that is asking cities to become locally productive and globally connected. Enjoy the show.
Tomás Díaz, I'm part of the Fab City Global Initiative. We're in a beautiful day in Amsterdam. As part of the We Make the City Festival, we have the Fab City Summit. We're welcoming here more than 60 people coming from all over the world of cities that are part of the Fab City network and also that are going to join the Fab City network as well. And we are having the luck to share maybe 10, 15 minutes with Kate Raworth, author of the Donuts Economics, and also trying to take people a little bit beyond the circular economy and beyond the traditional economic thinking. No?
I thought I was coming here for a drink.
We're having a drink.
I mean, with microphones.
We're having a drink with microphones, but and also this is going to be very informal at the
yes,
same time.
No, very no informal. Problem.
So I want to. I mean, since you have been, I don't have to tell in this room what the Fab City is. Yeah. You were in the Fab City Summit last year, yeah. In Paris. What has changed in the world? Because
The number of years and days has gone down.
Okay. What else?
What's changed in the world?
In 1 year.
In this year, okay. Greta, school strikes. In the UK where I live, Extinction Rebellion. And the government signing up for climate emergency. And of course, these kinds of things are happening in many countries. To me, what's changed is what's morally normal. Mm-hmm. So school kids, you know, well, a whole generation of people who said, you do climate change work. That's interesting. That's nice. That's your thing. Suddenly, it's everybody's thing, and it's almost people have to explain why they're not part of it. I had a very interesting experience. I was asked to go on Newsnight, which is a sort of main interview program on the news, on the day of the UK government agreeing that there's a climate emergency. And the producer of the TV program kept saying, well, we think we... And I said, do you want me to come or not? I'm in another city. I need to get on a train. He said, we really want you to come, but we can't find anybody to argue against you. I thought, that is change, because nobody wanted to go on and say, climate change, And to me, so that I think is the fundamental positive thing that's changed. Mm-hmm. And then many other political things are changing in the whole arena internationally of politics that is drawing attention away from this. My own country and its stupid Brexit obsession, right? We're not even talking about this. Mm-hmm. So there's a real split of far more public focus and awareness and a moral shift and then a political fractioning, I'd say. The other thing that's changed is I find when I go around giving talks and I talk about something as crazy as Cosmo local production, mm-hmm. people actually are listening because, and I think it's connected to school strikes, minds are opening up that the transformations we need are bigger than what we had in mind until now. And so you can talk about really transformative economic ideas and people are listening like they're listening to a possibility of a future.
So we have here in the room people coming from Mexico, coming from Brazil, coming from Seoul, also, of course, Europe. Do you think it's more or less the perception is the same in all these countries?
You'd have to tell me.
Okay.
You'd have to tell me.
So who
Each
wants
country
to...
Each country has its own story going on.
What's happening in Mexico? What's happening in Puebla?
Well, it's changing, but it's slow change. The mentality from school, from teachers, from government goes... I think, on my point of view, it's slow, but it's changing. It's changing about climate change, about fab cities or things that to produce in the surroundings of the city. It's not a very common idea, no? So it's good, it's changing, it's coming, but I don't know how long it's going to take to have a much more common mindset from people, government. There are a lot of levels of mindsets, you know.
Yeah. And I didn't ask, sorry, can you tell your name and where are you from?
My name is Javier. I am from the city of Puebla, close to Mexico City, about 2 hours from Mexico City. We have a FabLab Puebla there and in the Iberoamericana University, working with the municipality, which is about 1.5 million people in the city.
Yeah.
Then how we make the protests to turn into proposals? Like, you know, it's the awareness that, you know, the Fridays for the Future have created and all the movement in the world that, you know, we're seeing people sharing massively, making viral, you know, the trash pickups on Fridays, but still seems like a small, quote unquote, no? So what's the systemic, and of course you touched this in the Donald Economics,
so
what's the systemic transition that, you know, one thing leads to the other?
Okay, so I don't know if any of you know the three horizons theory of thinking about change. You've got horizon one, business as usual is dominant, the old mainstream capitalist wasteful system, and we want that to let go and leave, right? Mm-hmm. And then you've got the new world that you want to bring up and to become the future, but it's small now. The seeds are small, so that's normal that the seeds are small. What I try to do is to point to the practice. It's seeds, the Fab City. I show this. Mm-hmm. I show the examples of what's going on in Fab Labs. First, I put up a screen. it's got Japan, Netherlands, Spain, can't remember the fourth country on it, but all high-income countries. And I want people to think, oh, yeah, but this is just, you know, a sort of a rich country game. And then I put a picture of two men on mobile phones in the 1980s, and I say, do you remember in the 1980s when the only people who had mobile phones were these sort of dodgy businessmen?
Yeah.
And the mobile phone was a brick. I say, I think we're at that 1980s mobile phone moment with the Fab Lab, the Cosmolocal. At the moment, it seems like a strange, different thing that only special people can have. And then I show a picture of Bhutan and India and Dar es Salaam and Togo, and it's popping up everywhere. Mm. And I see in people's faces that, oh, this is real. And I think the examples that all of you create of, oh, this actually exists. It may be a seed, but it actually exists and exists everywhere. Because I think that 21st century economics will be practiced first and theorized later. I firmly believe that. And I'm so honored and delighted to be here. I completely believe you are practicing 21st century economics. And the theorists will come running after you and theorize what it is that you made happen. And so I say to them, by the way, if you want a word from the future, it's called cosmolocal production. And this is the cool term to leave my talk with, you know. You learned. Say you learned it here first, cosmolocal production. They all write it down. But no, I seriously think showing. Making visible possibility. There's nothing like it for changing people's mindsets.
I want to then pass to maybe some questions are coming from them. But I want to ask you, like, in this approach that you think, like, you know, things come with action, comes at small scale.
Yeah.
How we would deal with, like, the change of a mindset, or not change of a mindset? I would say, like, how do we deal with the long-term investments that are like a change of the whole infrastructure of the city?
Yeah.
Right? Like, I think about that, like, we built in the 19th and the 20th century, you know, we built infrastructure to move atoms around the world, right?
Yeah.
How, you know, you combine that with the planning that we need to build big infrastructure to keep the atoms in the cities and make the bits to travel in the world. So.
Yes. So, and I want to add to that. So I talked about two horizons. There's the old one that we want to let go and leave. There's the new one that we want to see build up. But there's a third horizon, which is the horizon of disruption and the disruptive design and disruptive possibility. And the question is, does it get captured by the old way, or does it actually bring through the new future? And to me, that's actually the power question. Because what you're doing and the model of business that you're showing is possible is completely disruptive. And I always do this in my talks now. I always say, you know, this is cosmolocal production. I always get off my chest, atoms are heavy. I always do that. They love it. And bits are light. So what you're doing is totally disruptive. Let atoms move locally, bits travel globally. But there are very, very different business models that could say, oh, we can make that happen. And you are the distributed version of that, the people, commons-based, peer-to-peer, distributed ownership, open. But as you know, there is also a closed, proprietary, corporate, centralized, controlled other way of doing this. And so to me, the real question is how, not only how do you set up the infrastructure to move bits, not atoms, but how do you set up a people's infrastructure to do that? Yeah. And how do you make sure that when you're doing it, and I think I'm showing this, and what if there's a big corporate in the room who says, thank you, we'll take that. And I, you know, we talked about this briefly before. I don't know the answer to this question. How do you make sure this amazing disruptive possibility is not captured and controlled and leaves these experiments as, a, you know, the people's tinkering?
Yeah, exactly.
What do you think? Well, I mean, and what do all of you think? Do you feel? Do you feel the fear of that? Do you feel the danger of that? And what is a strategic way to make sure that doesn't happen?
Well, that's happened with technology.
Exactly.
I mean, that there is a real danger. We are battling cyber cloud in Toronto. I'm from Canada. They're trying to control our cities through data, and lack of understanding the cities of what technology can actually do is allowing the technology companies to take ownership of our cities. So what is it to say that they can't take control of movements like this? So I don't. It's a real fear.
That's my very question.
I don't know how you combat it, though.
I was just reminded of an article I read years ago about bridges. And in medieval Europe, people would use bridges to get around the country. That would be an integral part of trade around, you know, the trade network throughout medieval Europe. But there'd be a way of paying for the bridges, either through tolls or through local contributions. Somebody would pay to keep up the bridge through the church or something like that. So because they understood that it was part of keeping the whole community together. I think we've come to some very centralized business models in the kind of digital revolution, but through things like the Mozilla Foundation and you know, open access technology and stuff like this. We're also, and also today we saw a development floating buildings that were using a cooperative to distribute their electricity and to kind of have the restoration of funding between them. So there are seeds, again, of new ways of doing things.
Yes.
I can add something as well, like, which is like the challenge that the, you know, and this is very like timely, because the challenge that the maker movement as maybe in the Americanized version had, is that, you know, leave this to the weekends. Let's just tinker, and this is a hobby. This is something that you do in your garage, and you know, you have fun, and you go to Maker Faire and to show what you did, right? And I think like the compromise, I put it in the other side. No, it's not like just to blame the corporate, but it's saying like, okay, what's the compromise that a distributed network can gain with changing how things work? It is to put in the agenda, not just to demonstrate that you are able to produce certain type of technology, but actually how that technology is relevant to what the world is asking, is screaming, is, you know, it's like you open the door and you see it. So I think that, you know, maybe, I don't know if you know, but Maker Media, which is a company that was running maker fairs around the world, probably one of the most, you know, front-facing events of the maker movement, went to bankruptcy just like a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. So it's like, and then the headlines were, the maker movement is dead, this is over, and so on, and so on, and so on. So I think that we need to learn from that. I put it in this room also, like learn from what is happening, that is, you know, the way that we are, you know, a part of this movement is putting what technology can do, cannot work with shareholders, and it cannot work in the how things work traditionally, let's say.
To pick up on that, I think, one of the challenges, we've got kind of these technology megaliths, these massive corporations, which if you talk to them, I've done some consulting work for fairly large companies, and their mindset is growth at all costs.
Okay.
So this idea is they've got no idea where they're scaling to. They're scaling to a point of global dominance where they are the service provider for every thought, every breath, and every need, right? It's just madness. So I think some of what we've got to think about doing is, you know, it's peer-to-peer, it's common ownership of digital technologies and digital infrastructure, it's collective power to be able to balance out the kind of lobbying that technology companies and large, you know, large companies are able to do. large companies with incredible wealth can lobby governments to forestall any kind of change, or at least the speed of change that we need to make. I mean, we've seen we've seen like permafrost melt. We've seen like the ice melt on tops of mountains, which is 70 years ahead of predictions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing things that are happening at such rapid rates of change. But the problem is we've got this established mechanism for stalling change because it ruins business models.
Yeah.
So the challenge is like, what kind of radical levers, what kind of radical options do we have in order to break through some of that? Because yes, distributed manufacturing, cosmopolitan localism, all of that stuff is to be celebrated, but I worry that it's not fast enough.
Can you think of anything that is? I mean, I mean that sincerely, because we can also go into a kind of rabbit in the headlight moment.
Yeah.
You know, when the UN, the IPCC said we've got 12 years to halve global carbon emissions, so many people, probably in your community as well, went and start saying we've got no time to change the system. We've just got to. But also, what the heck do we do? What is fast enough?
Yeah.
Anybody?
I don't know. It's the big question.
I've never worked for a big company. I don't particularly like big companies, but we work with these big companies a lot at Metabolic, and I would actually say the majority of them do genuinely want to change. If you look at, like, especially family companies, right? Like Danone is now a B Corp. They are completely judging their success based upon environmental and social indicators and impacts. The issue is that they're having to redesign a supply chain that they've built over 100 years. And if we're talking about, yes, like time is of the essence, somehow we've got to figure out how to radicalize within that system as well as work without it. Because if we remain totally detached from these large industries, we won't make it in time.
Can I add on what you're saying, Liz, as well? Just you're saying Danone need to change their supply chain that they've set up for 100 years. I ran a business workshop using, if that doesn't make any sense, sorry. I drew a picture that looks like a donut, which is a compass for meeting the needs of all people within the means of the planet. And the question, and businesses say, well, how can we be a business that's doing this? And so I did a workshop yesterday for 100 business people. Some of them, you know, consultants or three people startups, and some Shell and ABN AMRO were in the room. And what I always do with them is say, we can talk about the design of your product. So how do you make your product more circular? How do you make it more distributive in terms of employee owned or open source design or community empowering? But for all the time that we talk about your products, what we ultimately need to talk about is design of your business itself. And that's, and it comes back to your point about, you know, they're scaling to where, and why are they scaling to why, what's driving them? So I have this 5-point design traits of businesses that I find, I got it from an analyst called Marjorie Kelly. It's hugely useful for looking at any company or enterprise, the one you run or own or one you love or hate. So the first point is, what is its purpose? What does it actually exist to do? Why is it in the world? Second, how is it networked? We were talking about peer-to-peer, right? Who is its suppliers, its customers, its allies, its collaborators? What are the networks it moves in? And do those networks reinforce its purpose and values or actually detract from it? Thirdly, how is it governed? Who's in the boardroom or the decision-making meeting? But also, what are the rules and the principles? What are the metrics by which you judge your success? And what is the culture that you create? And what are the incentives of bonuses or payments that people are paid for? So you've got purpose, networks, and governance. Now to the heavy stuff. How is it owned? Because if an organization is owned by a family or a founding entrepreneur or employees or venture capital or shareholders, those very, very different ownership designs profoundly shape the last and most important one, which is finance and the quality and intent of finance. And I'll bet that the company that you're saying is scaling to where, it's driven by probably venture capital. That's, or a financial model that says, and now double, because the only thing in life that demands to scale endlessly is finance,
well, actually,
and the returns of finance.
Was
that not the case?
It's actually not the case. In this instance, it's a fairly well-established, 200-year technology company.
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Do they want to scale to dominate the platform just to be
what they've recognized is the market they're in the only way they can survive is platform dominance.
Right, okay, so that's the network
effect.
Because
they've gone, oh, okay, so we're a service provider in this area, and there's these all these other platform providers. They're going to take our market.
Right.
So how do we survive? We survive
right.
by offering something which is basically, we're your business friend, and we will supply everything you
right.
need. And then once they've done the B2B thing, they'll basically just scale that out again.
Right.
Because people will get excited about all of the opportunities. But the thing is, it just becomes this...
monolith.
It's this massive monolith. And we're just going to get to a point where we've got these companies vying for our everything. I mean, it's a little bit disturbing.
Yeah, yeah. But those five design traits, I would just also say, you know, in terms of the company that went, the maker
media
that went bankrupt.
Yeah.
So those five design traits are really good for understanding the dinosaurs and what drives them to grow endlessly. But they're also really, really valuable for thinking about your own enterprises that have been born to create the new economy. And are you robust up and down that list? And where are you vulnerable? And you're probably, you know, are you getting the finance you need? Probably not, because the finance is in the old model, not the new model. But they may be useful traits just to make sure, are we aligning our purpose, networks, governance, ownership, and finance to actually allow us to live in this space that we're creating? How can we strengthen the design of our own organizations?
Can I ask
it? And I'm probably going to have to slip away. Yes, Ruud is there. I thought I was coming for a drink. He made me sit here.
We've
got a couple of minutes. Okay.
So people are made out of bits.
Yes.
We're made out of
atoms.
Okay.
Just checking.
Freudian stuff. So people are made of bits.
Atoms?
Atoms.
You're trying to trick me.
So I've just got a concern.
Yeah.
That we're all about trying to keep atoms in one place. Does that mean that Fab City is anti-migration? And do these economic models, are we kind of anti-movement of people? Where does this whole economic model stand on workers, immigration, asylum, people moving around the world?
That's a really, really interesting question. I don't have the answer. I wonder if you guys have thought from that one. It's about people not moving continually around the world, because a lot of the flights, most of the flights that are, 200,000 flights that have happened on planet Earth today, were not people emigrating. There were people vacationing or doing business. And you guys, But I think it's a really interesting point that you don't want to end up in a spirit of autarky and isolationism and shutting barriers. No atoms go in, no atoms go out. And how do you hold a social consciousness and justice at the same time as holding this ambition, which almost does say, well, actually, in terms of things that we make, atoms stay. But in terms of and even probably in terms of living being, all other living beings, they should stay, right? We want actually species to thrive in the ecosystems to which they belong. But we're asking for an exceptionalism for humans, that we actually should have the right to move, and that there's a fear of, you're not from here, go back to where your atoms began, right? I think it's a really, really good point.
I think there is the notion of staying, you know, locally productive, globally connected, I think states some of the vision that we don't want to be a medieval city in which you control the walls. At the same time, it makes me think about the weak points that we have is that the metrics part. Because when you were saying the metrics, which is associated with your values, then you define in those metrics that this is not moving people or just rejecting different race, nationality, whatever, right? But then it leads me to the last question, which is connected to the fact that we see that the race of populism, right? And some of this populism is associated with keeping the atom locally, which is more or less what Gareth was saying. The thing is, a lot of that discourse is getting into some people very deep, right? How we learn from that? How we get deep into other values that are intrinsic to us, that are beyond this kind of myths that we have created, that we are different and we are disconnected and so on. Do you have what causes you, like, what do you feel when you see the race of these movements that are somehow disconnecting from us from each other?
The way I choose to work, and maybe I think, given that you're the self-selection of the all you're here, you're probably also choosing to work, is you focus on building the world you want to see, and you make it visible. And I think so many people, some people retreat into the populism out of fear, mm-hmm. and out of feeling that they're not being treated justly. So deeply unequal societies, and people look for someone to blame about my misfortune, and they blame the other. And we need to model the possibilities of places actually where there is diversity and strong community and people thriving together. There's also really interesting research that shows when children grow up in diverse communities, they are not racist in choosing who they trust. Mm-hmm. When children grow up in very homogeneous communities that they're only surrounded by other children of their own race, they only will trust people who look like themselves. So it starts very, very young. And so we have to make and model these places. I just always find that when I'm giving talks, if I'm talking about distributive design or regenerative design, somebody can be sitting there thinking theory, theory, theory. If I put up a picture, and I use FabLab pictures, put up a picture, well, here's somewhere it's happening. You can feel a shift in the room of, oh, what I want to say is impossible is no longer impossible because she just showed me it being done somewhere. It's so powerful. So I wrote a book with a picture of a donut in it. And this, I drew this donut in 2012, and it has had way, way more traction than I ever imagined. And I had to think very, very hard about why are people responding so much to this? And I would say to people, they say, I love you, da-da. I'd say, why? What? It's a picture of the world we actually want to create. And people are desperate for the positive, visual, made physical, made real inspirations. I hear you've all been on floating houses.
Yeah.
I'm damn jealous, right? I want to go to those places too, because that you take that home and say, I see this possibility. I now believe in it. It's working. Okay, it's tricky. It's working. It's real. I now believe it. People say, you know, it's going around the UK a lot. Many people find it easier to imagine the end of the world than to imagine the end of capitalism. It is hard to imagine the end of capitalism as we know it, unless you go around and see floating houses that are sharing their electricity through a cooperative. Because it sounds impossible, and then you see it. So absolutely, keep on making it real and visible and framing it positively. We were just chatting. I never use the word degrowth because it's just telling you what it's against.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to say what you're for. So I talk about regenerative and distributive economies that regenerate the cycles of the living world, that distribute value far more equitably with all who co-create it. And just keep showing the positive, where we want to get to. I profoundly believe that's very powerful.
But,
and on that bombshell.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's a very beautiful way to set up this conversation,
probably,
to finish the conversation.
I promise to be somewhere. Yeah, thank you so much.
But
for
we will open other chances.
Next time, can I come with you on the tour of the floating places?
Yes, yes, please.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kate.
Thomas.
Thanks for listening. The Future Talks podcast is produced by us at FabLab Barcelona with happiness. This episode was recorded in Amsterdam at the We Make the City Festival 2019. Special thanks to the Fab City Foundation and We Make the City Festival. Music by Nua, art by Leina Sofia.